Coming up on Weekend America.
It was just a little movie about flesh-eating murderous zombies. What could go wrong?
At the beginning of the film, little children were running up and down the aisles. Then as it progressed, you saw them get quieter and quieter until they were crying and hiding under their seats.
Night of the Living Dead, 40 years later, still not a family film. I'm John Moe, also out of the octagon and into the barracks.
On the battlefield, it's a fight for your life. We're not training to win in the cage or to win in the ring. We're training to win, you know, on the battlefield in Iraq or Afghanistan or wherever we happen to fight next. And in those fights, of course, there are no rules.
And who comes up with that music for cable news? This guy.
Music tells the viewer, first and foremost, stay in the chair, don't change the channel.
Weekend America, after the news.
Weekend America's founding sponsor is Target.
From American Public Media, it's Weekend America. I'm John Moe. We're going down to Georgia this hour, where soldiers at Fort Benning are getting trained in the latest military technology. No, it's not a new laser weapon system. It's ultimate fighting. We also visit a used book sale where there's a fair bit of fighting as well. Many more Tom Clancy's in attendance than Emily Dickinson's, if you get my drift. Plus, you know that scary music they play on the news for coverage of the war or the financial crisis? We meet the composer. What song best describes the economy?
I would think the best song would be Robert Johnson's Down at the Crossroads.
The End of the World as We Know It by R.E.M.
Crash by Dave Matthews Band. Probably Rescue Me or Help by Aretha Franklin.
Barracuda by Heart because of the greed exercised by so many of the Wall Street firms.
The song Got Money, just because it says if you got money, take it out and show it. Nobody really has money to show right now.
What about that song where they said everything's going to be all right? Remember that one? Those voices came from Phoenix, Arizona, Lincoln, Nebraska, and Birmingham, Alabama. Okay, right. So another crazy, scary week. Financial industry in trouble. One member of Congress said Friday may be remembered as the day America collapsed, and I hope they're wrong, but wow. There was a standoff with pirates in Africa this week. Pirates. They communicated through a pirate spokesman, which is a job title I've never heard of. And they weren't charming Johnny Depp pirates either. They were horrible pirates. We will talk about the economy and the debate a little later, but we also feel like it's the weekend, and for a moment, maybe you want to get away from the scary news a bit. So, we're going to talk about zombies.
68 was like an earthquake.
The country was not on the cusp of revolution.
There appeared to be as many policemen as demonstrators.
But it was certainly on the cusp of some enormous millennial change.
Now we hear you loud and clear, boy.
It still does resonate even when people don't realize that it's resonating.
It's part of our series This Weekend in 1968, spotlighting how the events of 40 years ago shaped America. Back then, this weird zombie flick, Night of the Living Dead, was not only a hit, but a sort of prism through which people could see all sorts of social issues of the day. But in conversations with the filmmakers and the actors, we learned that that wasn't really the plan. They just wanted to make a real cool zombie movie.
There are two of them out there. Have you seen any more around here?
I'm John Russo. I was co-author of Night of the Living Dead, along with George Romero, and I also played the part of a zombie who gets a tire iron in the head. And I had a very memorable line that was... Well, I went to see every movie that came into town, and I always wanted to see a good horror film, and you usually didn't.
The Beast from 20,000 Fathoms.
I mean, they'd had these things with Attack of the Giant Grasshopper.
The Black Scorpion destroys communication.
And they all had formulaic plots.
We'll call the National Guard back.
And in the end, the National Guard comes in and wipes it out with flamethrowers.
Tell them we need some heavy equipment, guns, tanks, anything.
And so we wanted to make a movie that really paid off the people that bought tickets to horror films.
It is basically a storyline of people who are in a very rural setting.
Russ Dreiner was the co-producer of Night of the Living Dead.
They've got two major problems that they're dealing with. Number one are the unrelenting undead things that have surrounded the farmhouse that they're holed up in.
There is an epidemic of mass murder being committed by a virtual army of unidentified assassins.
And the second major problem they have is dealing with their own reactions within the house.
You're insane. The cellar's the safest place.
Telling you they can't get in here.
In a nutshell, that's the hopelessness of their situation.
And so this incredible story becomes more ghastly with each report.
George Romero and I were both working on script ideas, and I said to George, this is all really good, but who are these attackers? And George said he hadn't figured that out yet. And I said, it seems to me they could be dead people. And he said, oh, that's good. My idea was aliens were coming to Earth in search of human flesh. And I said, why don't we use my flesh-eating idea? And George said, oh, that's good.
Medical authorities in Cumberland have concluded that in all cases, the killers are eating the flesh of the people they murdered.
You know, zombies weren't heavyweight fright material like werewolves and vampires until we turned them into flesh eaters. Then they became terrifying.
Test. Back on. Oh. We're coming back on the air after an interruption due to technical problems.
The cemetery scene is the very opening scene of the film. I'm Russ Streiner. I was the co-producer of the original Night of the Living Dead. I was also the character of Johnny, the annoying brother, right at the very beginning of the film.
There's nothing wrong with the radio. Must have been the station.
I am Judith O'Day. I played Barbara.
Which row is it in?
We're coming up into an old, dark, gloomy cemetery.
To put a wreath on our father's grave.
We go to the gravesite.
You used to really be scared here.
Johnny!
They see an elderly person wandering in the cemetery.
He figures this is a wonderful way to play on Barbara's fears.
That coming to get you, Barbara.
My line to him is...
Stop it! You're ignorant.
They're coming for you, Barbara.
Look, that comes one of them now.
But sure enough, as I cross by this fellow's path, he reaches out and attacks me. Johnny comes to my aid. He is killed. And I run to save my life. Children and adults were terrified by this movie. I can remember the Chicago Sun came out with an article that said, at the beginning of the film, little children were running up and down the aisles. They had their popcorn, and they were so excited. Then as it progressed, you saw them get quieter and quieter, until, at the very end, they were crying and hiding under their seats. I've had several decades of family come up and said, you scared me to death when I was a little kid. The first thing out of my mouth is, oh, I am so sorry. Then I stop myself. I think, well, I guess that's what we were supposed to do. In 1968, when everything was going on with all the racial problems in the country,
we made the decision to cast an African-American actor, Dwayne Jones, in the lead male role.
Don't worry about him. I can handle him. Probably be a lot more of them as soon as they find out about us.
Well, we cast Dwayne Jones because he was the best actor that read for the part. But that being said, I was very much aware of the effect Dwayne being black would have, especially in towns in the South where we still had, you know, white and colored water fountains and all that.
We have to wait for Johnny.
It was written in the script that Barbara was to smack Ben at least three times.
Please! We have got to go get Johnny!
But
please,
this was a very sensitive issue for Dwayne Jones at the time. And he said, I can accept being smacked once, but I don't want to play it the way you've written it. It was rewritten.
Your brother is dead.
No! My brother is not dead!
I gave him a smack. And he gave me the fist. Right in the face.
Oh,
And then she folds into his arms. And I know that a lot of the bigots in the country are going to be thinking, oh, my God, now what's he going to do? He's got this white woman in his arms, and he lays her down on the couch, and he unfastens her coat. And so I was aware that it might have those kind of vibes. But we were out to make a lot of noise. We were out to be iconoclastic, and we didn't flinch. By the same token, we weren't actively thinking about making a social statement. We just wanted to make the scariest movie that we could possibly make.
One of the most terrifying scenes for me was the scene where Barbara really comes out of her catatonia. Somebody is breaking in, or somebody's. They've grabbed Helen Cooper by the throat or by the hair. Barbara snaps to. She pulls her away from the door. But in doing so, these zombies are breaking in. And what she sees at that door just completely blows her mind. It's her brother Johnny. He grabs her. I'm literally swallowed up by these zombies, and that, we assume, is Barbara's demise. Our film was different at that point than any other, in that not even one of them survived. At that time, that was so frightening to so many people.
All law enforcement agencies and the military have been organized to search out and destroy the marauding ghouls.
There is a scene where there are all kinds of people, a huge posse, that is, walking with their rifles to shoot the zombies.
Chief, if I were surrounded by 6 or 8 of these things, would I stand a chance with them?
If you had a gun, shoot them in the head. That's a sure way to kill them.
I've never had a lot of confidence in people to act sanely, especially when they're in the mob. And certainly we were seeing mobs, you know. Even at the peace rally, everybody's for peace here, but when they're in a mob, you don't know what they're going to do. And so that brought me to mention that somebody would get killed, and wouldn't it be ironic if it were our hero, Ben?
All right, Vince, hit him in the head, right between the eyes. Good shot. Okay, he's dead. Let's go get him. That's another one for the fire.
Does Night of the Living Dead reflect the time of 1968? Absolutely. It, in a way, mirrors so much of what was happening at that time.
And I think when you put those circumstances together, coupled with the fact that it was a very good story, it's still around 40 years after the fact, and it will be around, I'm convinced, a lot after we are not.
That was Russ Streiner, Judy O'Day, and John Russo. Dwayne Jones, who was the hero in the film, died in 1988. The story was produced by Ann Hepperman and Kara Oler. You can see more from the film on our website, some spooky pictures, as well as find out how zombies are getting political today. That's at weekendamerica.org.
Weekend America is brought to you in part by Target, giving 5% of its income to the community since 1946. That now adds up to over $3 million every week. And Constant Contact, dedicated to helping small businesses and nonprofits build stronger customer relationships through email marketing. ConstantContact.com.
Congress passes a bailout. Obama, McCain, and Biden vote yes. Sarah Palin says, hey, I know, let's take the $700 billion and build some more bridges. Then she winks. Next on Weekend America. It's Weekend America. I'm John Moe. Well, the news of the week involves baseball also, besides financial crises, and it's really easy to figure out if it's good news or bad news in baseball. If you live in Tampa or Boston or Los Angeles or Philadelphia, good news. If you live in, different parts of Los Angeles, Anaheim, I guess that's bad news. Milwaukee, bad news. Chicago, really bad news. But what about the rest of the week? It gets a little more complicated when you review the rest of the news. And here to review the news of the week is our panel. John Ridley is the editor-in-chief of ThatMinorityThing.com. Hi, John.
Hey, John. How are you?
Good. From Current TV, Sarah Haskins. Hello, Sarah.
Hello.
And New Yorker cartoon editor Bob Mankoff. Hi, Bob.
Reviewing as I speak.
Okay. First off, you know how you get that kind of queasy feeling when you make a major purchase, like a car or a house or even a fridge? Magnify that by a zillion, and that's Congress this week, which deliberated on a $700 billion bill to bail out the financial industry. The measure failed early in the week, but it was passed by the Senate on Wednesday and passed by the House on Friday. It then went on to the president, who signed it. Was this bailout good news, bad news, or no news?
Good news, good news, good news. I mean, I'll take the chant from the Republican convention and just shift it around. IRA, IRA, IRA.
Pass, baby, pass.
But I was protected. I had diversified all my money among my mattresses. So silly to put all your eggs in one mattress.
It's good news.
Why?
It's just good news I'm so angry about. Well, I think it's good news because we had to do something, even if it is a symbolic gesture that might destroy us.
Why are you angry?
Because when I graduated from college, I knew people who were going to get rich in investment banking and do those things. That's what they wanted to do. I don't want to be rich. They can go make as much money as they want, but the implicit deal was they could do that as long as they didn't destroy the country. And then they did. It's completely screwed up.
And now you're getting the bill.
Yeah.
I think other than the size of the bailout, the potential size, if it goes as high as the $700 billion or higher, that's news. But I think it's no news. I think that the boom-bust cycle, the bailout cycle, and we've done this before, we can see this coming. You know, we can see it with the tech bubble. You could see it with SNL. You could see it coming. Nobody cares because we're all drunk and we're all making money. We've seen this before.
No, not to this extent. Not taking over, nationalizing huge financial institutions. I think it's very, very important because in any reasonable way, it says, put sort of a kibosh on the idea that there really is a free market that doesn't need controls.
This is great news for you, Bob, from a professional standpoint.
Really? I mean, everybody says, oh, this is so complicated. It's derivative credit default swaps. A cartoon I did in New York a while ago is a CEO on the phone saying, a billion is 1,000 millions. Why wasn't I informed of that?
Okay, let's move on. The vice presidential candidates conducted a much-anticipated debate on Thursday night. In terms of helping people make up their minds, was the debate good news, bad news, or no news?
Well, I found it incredibly informational. I had no idea there was a maverick party.
A team of mavericks.
I mean, this is just fantastic. I thought it was sort of funny. I thought Biden should have said, I thought you were a Republican, and it turns out there's a whole party of two people.
I would have to say that it was largely no news. I don't think either side had this terrifically magnificent performance. I do think if it were to skew towards good news, which I know I'm moving out of my what I'm actually allowed to categorize. You know, I know I'm supposed to be in a little box and be defined by red state, blue state, or what have you. But I think that good news for Obama in the sense that Joe Biden talking about his family and being a single dad and getting choked up, that he's a human and he's been through some human things and he delivered in a human fashion, not just talking about his family, but for a minute, this guy who is so verbose and goes on and on lost himself in his family. And I thought that was a big moment.
I think it was good news for folksy lexicons.
You betcha.
Yeah. Oh, darn tootin'. It stayed boring. So it was no news. People wanted something they could make a decision on. They wanted Sarah Palin to know absolutely nothing and use no words. She came close.
It's no news in terms of the election and changing. That's certainly true.
Yeah.
It's news in terms of what you got to talk about in the morning after it happens. Yeah, I was entertained. I was entertained also by just the idiocy of the debates in general. They can't question each other. There's no dialogue. It's not a debate.
Beyond that, even when she said, and again, I don't want to come off beating up too much on Sarah Palin, but when she said, I'm not going to answer these questions the way you ask them or the way you want me to. I mean, she literally said, mm-hmm. I'm taking the concept of debate off the table and I will simply say what I want to say, which at that point is, well then go give a speech. I mean, honestly, go give a speech and move people as you choose, as opposed to engaging the question and answer process, even if superficially, as politicians often do.
All right, last topic. Every country who is likely to get a Nobel Prize for Literature, take a step forward. Not so fast, America. The Nobel Committee will award its prizes next week, but this week, Permanent Secretary Horace Engdahl raised eyebrows when he said that American writers were too sensitive to trends in their own mass culture and that dragged down the quality of their work. Of course, there's powerful literature in all big cultures, he said, but you can't get away from the fact that Europe still is the center of the literary world, not the United States. Slammed by the guy from the Nobel Prize Committee. Good news, bad news, or no news? Why don't we start this one with novelist John Ridley?
I would, you know, this is tough to exactly categorize between no news and good news. I think it's no news because I agree with this. I think that American literature has suffered both because of the fact that it's become more of a business than art. It tends to be just sort of this dysfunctional white guy porn, you know, that's what the literature is. Look at our dysfunctional family, look at our dysfunction. And it is sort of insular.
Yeah, I should be reading more.
Well,
of
unfortunately,
it.
It's the porn without sex, you know. So I would agree with that. And I think I say no news because I think that to me it's been that way. It's just sort of bland. And then I think it's good news because somebody's calling it out. You're getting a little, you know, writers and novelists, they're just boring people. You know, the whole concept has gotten boring. And the fact that there's like a smackdown going on in the Nobel literati, I mean, this is like, okay, let's go. Who's going to be the American to step up and go in your face, you know, and get nasty? But I would like writing that was just bigger and it was more ambitious. So I think it's good that he's actually starting some trouble.
It was good news because it shows that European writers are big.
You're just being reactionary. You're taking it personally.
I think it's good news.
Why?
In part because I'm looking for any excuse to go to a bar and have too many drinks and get in a fight about books. A good old-time literary martini-throwing fight.
All right. Well, that's the news of the week. Thankfully, now we understand all of it. Panel, thanks.
Thank you.
Thanks,
John.
Weekend America's own team of mavericks. John Ridley is the editor-in-chief of ThatMinorityThing.com. Bob Mankoff is the cartoon editor at The New Yorker. And from Current TV's Infomania, Sarah Haskins.
Weekend America is supported in part by an award from the National Endowment for the Arts, which believes that a great nation deserves great art. This program is made possible by grants from CPB, the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, with support from public radio stations including WBUR Boston, WCPN Cleveland, and KPCC Los Angeles.
Army guys go up against each other with punches, kicks, and jabs. What, no kung fu grip? A look at ultimate fighting in the Army ahead on Weekend America. From American Public Media, it's Weekend America. I'm John Moe. And it's time for your letters. Our story on Reggie Prim, who was shipped off to Israel when his mother became a member of the group The Black Hebrews, generated a lot of listener comments. Some, like Rosie Bear, felt the neglect and abuse he suffered didn't get enough scrutiny in the story.
As I was listening to the story, I was very disturbed by the abuse that he suffered. And the story was, it was done in a very kind of neutral, non-commenting way, that it just kind of let his experience speak for itself. And then the last line I remember hearing was, Reggie Prim no longer practices Judaism. So that last line sort of made it seem as if this is a Jewish thing. And I think there's a lot of ignorance in the general public about Judaism, and to hear that line made me worry that people would think, oh, yeah, this is how Jews treat their children.
Reggie Prim's story also drew positive comments. Pete Tiedemann of Minneapolis is a friend of Reggie's, and he wrote to thank Weekend America for doing the piece.
This story is not a story about abuse, abandonment, music, or Black Hebrews. It's really the story of one man's triumph of life, and that's Reggie Prim. He brings us the gifts that he does in the world, and his willingness to examine some of the most difficult experiences in his own life bring understanding to the rest of us.
A few weeks ago, we brought you Chrissy Clark's story about Wangston's Law, that you shouldn't talk about anything that you can easily Google. Listener Kay Collins of Chicago reminds us that librarians used to be the final arbiters of bar bets, and she should know, she was one.
One I can remember getting in my work was Santa's Reindeer. Well, any good reference librarian, I was a law librarian, would have the seasonal questions set up and so they could just read them off. But the fun ones were the ones that came in 8:30, 9 o'clock after everybody'd had a few glasses of wine and those were the good questions because they were off the wall. They could be anything. What color is Jack's milk? It's pink. For a while, the librarians were afraid that computers would pull them out of jobs, but no, they're more important than ever because not everything, you have to know when to Google it. And you have to know when to use paper, and you have to be able to verify your source. Just because it's on the web does not mean that it's real. The perfect example of that is a Sarah Palin banned books list. I proved that the list was false on the second book I checked. Wasilla didn't even hold it. You know, it's a librarian thing.
Wait, Yak's milk is pink? I'm kind of still tripped up on that one. Okay, finally, Jack Beck of Portland, Oregon wrote in to complain. He says, have you noticed that all the people you ask what they are doing for the weekend at the beginning of your show do not say they are going to listen to the radio? I get the impression from all those people that I am a loser if I listen to Weekend America, that I should be doing something else. Well, no, Jack, you're not a loser. Of course you're not a loser. You are a winner. And not just because you're listening to our show. That's not the only reason I'm saying that. We recently found out that a surprisingly large percentage of our listeners listen along with other people. They're in a group. They're in some kind of social situation. And it's more than on other shows that you hear on public radio. So think about it. If you listen to Weekend America, that means you have friends and that people love you. And we love you too, Jack. When are you coming by the studio, Jack? We want to know what you think about any part of our show, from the very beginning to the story you had trouble with to the story you found fascinating. This is a two-way conversation, and, you know, I can't do all the talking. If you have a question or comment about something that you heard, drop us a line. We'll be right back.
Weekend America's founding sponsor is Target.
It's Weekend America. I'm John Moe. This weekend at Fort Benning in Columbus, Georgia, soldiers from posts all over the world are competing in the All-Army Combatives Championship. The tournament involves soldiers fighting each other, using whatever manual methods are available to bring their opponents down. Punches, kicks, flips, holds, you name it. It has echoes of those ultimate fighting contests that are rapidly gaining popularity on TV. It's even a little reminiscent of G.I. Joe fighting Team Cobra. But it's as real as a punch in the head. Reporter Philip Gratzer has more.
Red ready. Blue ready. Fight!
At the sound of the bell, Master Sergeant Sean Morris and Sergeant Charles Ganong circle each other in the ring. Within seconds, the two are going hard at each other, jabbing and simultaneously kicking. Morris lets loose a few more jabs and then clips Ganong with a kick right behind the knee. Ganong goes down. If this sounds more like ultimate fighting than your average basic training, you're right. The Army calls it combatives, but it's essentially the same thing as the popular sport known as ultimate fighting or mixed martial arts. It's a brutal mix of wrestling, boxing, and karate. It has a big following among 18 to 25-year-old men.
It gets guys that we want in the Army, guys who want to fight.
That's Sergeant Damian Skelly. He also competes in civilian mixed martial arts competitions. He's billed as the Fighting Ranger. When Skelly beats a civilian at an ultimate fighting match, he hopes some of the guys in the crowd will consider joining up.
We can get guys who want to fight, who want to go out there and scrap with the other guy, which is that's what we want right there. So you don't really get that a lot with the college options and the GI Bill and stuff. You get a lot of people who come into the Army thinking, what can the Army do for me kind of thing.
Mixed martial arts started in 1993 as a way to pit wrestlers, boxers, and karate experts against each other. Early on, the matches were so brutal that it was called human cockfighting. But as it grew in popularity, the sport became a mix of all the martial arts, and it was more regulated. Now there's no gouging, no fish hooking, and no elbows to the back of the head. In 1995, the Army started their own program and called it Combatives. But unlike mixed martial arts, combatives isn't a sport. It's about training soldiers in hand-to-hand combat. Still, the Army program has elements that seem more like gang initiation than basic training. One drill, according to Skelly, is particularly traumatic. It's nicknamed the punch drill.
The student has to close the distance on their opponent while getting punched with a closed fist in the head with little protective gear, and they can't punch back. They just have to close the distance, wade through the punches, and achieve the clinch.
The clinch is when the student gets inside his opponent's fists, close enough to bear hug him. The idea of pitting soldiers against each other one-on-one might seem odd. After all, the Army relies more on teamwork to win battles than individual acts of glory. Matt Larson, the director of the Army's Combatives Program, believes that the training is more of a team-building exercise than one might think.
You know, you always get that young soldier in who's this is the first time away from home, and he's not really developed into a grown-up yet. And of course, he'd start getting beat up right away. Pretty soon, he beats somebody. And at that moment, he'd flower into a full member of the unit.
Larson admits that the program is grueling, and he thinks that's how it should be. Unlike the civilians who call themselves ultimate fighters, Army combatants are not fighting for fame and fortune.
On the battlefield, it's a fight for your life. We're not training to win in the cage or to win in the ring. We're training to win, you know, in the battlefield, in Iraq or Afghanistan or wherever we happen to fight next. And in those fights, of course, there are no rules.
Sergeant Keoki Smythe knows this firsthand. Smythe's built like a bull and just as powerful. He's been training in combatives for 12 years. Last year, Smythe was on patrol with his unit in Ramadi, Iraq. They were jumpy because the last time they were here, they'd been hit by an IED.
We halted real quick before we crossed the main road, and this Iraqi camp was coming towards me, a military-age male. I told him in Arabic to stop, Keef. I stood in front of him, I told him to stop, and he shoved me.
Now, under military rules, that shove was considered an assault. Smythe could have shot the Iraqi. Instead, he used what he learned in combatives.
As he passed by me, I wrapped him up in the rear naked choke. So I took my arm, I wrapped it around his neck. I grabbed my bicep, my opposite hand goes behind his head, stepped on the back of his knee and faced him towards a wall so that we could continue movement without interference from him.
For Smythe and the Iraqi civilian, it turned out to be a win-win situation. Combatives probably saved the Iraqi's life. And for Smythe, he learned that he didn't always need his weapon to gain the upper hand. In Fort Benning, Georgia, I'm Philip Graetzer for Weekend America.
We've got video of soldiers beating each other up. I'm looking at it now. Ouch! On our website, weekendamerica.org. Doing a little reading this weekend, maybe poking through a used bookstore. This week, people will be lining up at the library sale in Brookfield, Connecticut, eager to find some bargains, and there will be thousands of books, many going for as low as 50 cents. But many of the people buying them aren't really interested in reading them. See, you used to have to be a bookworm to know which books you could turn around and sell for 20 bucks, but no longer. An invention has come along and made all that studying unnecessary. Reporter David Maxson explains how it has completely transformed a once sleepy industry.
It's early Saturday morning in Newtown, Connecticut, and about 200 people are standing in line outside a local elementary school. Jay and her son Alan are right at the front.
When did you get here to get first in line?
On Thursday.
This isn't a rock concert. It's the Friends of the C.H. Booth Library Book Sale. And all these folks are booksellers. When this sale started 33 years ago, it was no more than a booth at a local parade. This year, there's a mad rush when the doors open. Jay heads for the stacks.
A stampede is the word. Fights break out, people cutting in line. I've actually had guys grab the same book out of a box that I do and not want to let go. Try and do like a tug of war. You sit there like, are you kidding me? You're 40 years old. Let go. I was here first.
Fights are not uncommon. The Newtown Police Department sends a deputy to the sale every year, just in case it gets out of hand. So how did this cute little charity book sale become so intense? Mary Mackey, one of the sale's organizers, says the culprit is technology.
Probably around 2000, we noticed college-age kids coming in with their scanners.
These digital tools help people find out exactly what a book sells for online. One bookseller here has a $1,000 PDA that scans barcodes and tells her the book's price on Amazon.com.
$12.17.
All this technology has turned people into book harvesting machines. College kids, stay-at-home parents, retirees, they're all getting in on the action. Matthew Singer runs a bookstore called Airstream Books in Brooklyn. He's an old-fashioned bookseller. He relies on specialized knowledge of arcane books that don't have barcodes. He does not use technology to find books.
Not at all, no, no. I like to use my brain. And scanners will often scan a book, and if it doesn't meet their criteria, they'll generally just pile it up. It can get a little out of hand, and it's obnoxious, really, you know, because the barrier to entry is so easy. You don't really have to have much knowledge about, you know, printed matter.
The scanners can cut profits for traditional sellers like Matthew, putting some of them out of business. But with the barrier to entry so low, technology-dependent sellers could become victims of their own success, and they seem to realize that. When I posted to the Amazon Sellers Forum, trying to get information for this story, no one wanted to talk. One told me, loose lips sink ships. I asked Jay to explain.
There's already too many of us out here, and, well, it's like you get a bunch of amateurs coming in, then it affects everybody else's business. So.
After the initial rush when the doors fly open, it's actually remarkably quiet. All you can hear is the sound of shuffling books. Concentration is intense. Some dealers drip with sweat, even in the air-conditioned gymnasium. Jay and her son are busily scanning away. I ask how much she hopes to make today.
I usually try and work in multiples of 10, but I'm not sure.
So if you buy a book for a dollar?
I hope to sell it for 10, yeah.
So the profit potential is definitely there. That is, until someone invents a robot that makes human booksellers completely obsolete. From Newtown, Connecticut, I'm David Maxson for Weekend America.
Check out some photos of sweat dripping off the faces of book buyers in mid-search. Wow, these pictures are kind of intense. It's all at our website, weekendamerica.org. Tropical storm Marie is swirling about 800 miles off the coast of Mexico. Here's good news after a rough hurricane season. Marie is expected to dissipate and cause no real problems for anyone. Huh. For a look at weather and fun across America, here's Stephanie Curtis.
Folks in Aramo, Idaho are a determined bunch. They want to race their snowmobiles, and they won't let things like 54 degrees or showers or reality get in their way. They host the Extreme Snowmobile Grass Drags, which is precisely what it sounds like. Looking forward to the suntan and body surfing contests coming up in January. Parents in Port Allen, Louisiana have it rough. Their town is holding Sugar Fest under sun in 85. It honors one of the major regional crops and features music, crafts, food, and I don't think they need vegetables, and hands-on sugar experiments. For kids, those experiments include bouncing off the walls and not sleeping till Thursday. Prescott, Arizona is going to settle the score once and for all at the Man Against Horse Race. Courses of 12, 25, and 50 miles. Not sure which species is more helped by thunder and 67 degrees. Who do I think will win? I think the horses. Why? They're horses, and it's a race. Get them in a human contest, though, and we'd smoke them. Text messaging? TV watching? You're going down, horses. For more information on these and other events, go to weekendamerica.org with a little bit of weather everywhere. I'm Stephanie Curtis for Weekend America.
Economic collapse, war, healthcare, big news stories. But do they have a good beat and can you dance to them? The music of the news, next on Weekend America.
Weekend America is supported by Gather.com, where friends keep up with the people, conversations, and moments that matter most. People are talking about their weekends at Gather.com. And the American Public Transportation Association, committed to helping Americans save on gas and become energy independent at publictransportation.org.
It's Weekend America. I'm John Moe. The cable news channels are full of election coverage this weekend, and along with that coverage comes music. Think about it. When was the last time you watched the news and didn't hear theme music announcing the major events of the day? And even though it has no informational content, music is a big part of the news. One of the giants of news composition is Peter Fish. You've heard his work. He's written themes for CBS, MTV, Fox. You know that shkung from the old Current Affairs show? That one? Yeah, he wrote that. Peter, you wrote that one, Peter?
Yes, I did. That's going to be on my epitaph. He did the ka-chung.
What does music add to news?
Music tells the viewer, first and foremost, stay in the chair, don't change the channel. If I'm walking away from the set and I hear some notes of a show I might actually like to watch, I turn around, I sit down again.
Let's walk through the process from when these things first start out to when they finally hit the air. How does that work?
Basically, how I get the work is someone calls me and says, either we want you to do this or we want you to bid on doing this.
And when they say this, what do they come to you with? We have a financial crisis? We have a war?
Well, it depends. I mean, it could be anything from a full brand new television show or program down to the specific crises at hand. The crises at hand, frankly, are not so much the stock and trade anymore because people really don't have the budget to produce music for the crises at hand. They produce packages of music where they envision the majority of the crises that could occur. It's sort of like, you know, a crisis is coming. It may be a financial crisis like we're currently involved with, or it may be a war, or it may be an assassination, or you know, heaven forbid, something like that. But crises will be there.
What goes into the creative act for you in terms of inspiration?
I'm driven by the client's laundry list. I'm well aware that the client is going to want a solemn version of the music, and they're going to want a churning sort of disturbed version of the music, and they're going to want an up and happy version of the music, and they're going to want the election version of the music. I mean, you know, and there's what I call, and with some trepidation I'll say this, they're going to want the dead pope version of the music because a pope will die.
What's the difference in terms of like the instruments that you're using?
Oh, it's vastly different. If I'm doing the solemn version of music, there's going to be rich and deep, luxurious strings with not a lot of motion, not da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da, but like boom. And there's going to be maybe a tubular bell tolling now and again, maybe a solitary French horn, a snare drum playing a tap sort of figure deep in the background, way back in your hearing consciousness. And if I'm doing the, hey, it's Easter version, it's going to be with, you know, two acoustic guitars and maybe an electric guitar and maybe a flute and bass, drums, piano and a happy tambourine and, you know.
Well, what's the difference between different networks in terms of their sound? Like CBS, what's CBS looking for?
In the broadest sense, CBS is traditional. They like orchestral sounding material. Fox News is sort of like writing for sports. Everything is a battle. And everything's like, you know, kill, beat, maim, you know. PBS is not only traditional, but subdued. It's more chamber orchestra. It's more string quartet. It's more jazz chamber group.
If you're working within all these parameters and within all these things that people are giving you to create this product, does that lessen what you're doing as a work of art?
Oh, most definitely. I'm not an artist. I'm a craftsman. I'm a really good craftsman. And when I am an artist, it's not in this realm. I mean, there's things I do for myself with bands I perform in, my own group, et cetera, et cetera. To me, that's the art, but I don't worry about the commerce of that. In the world of commerce, which is where we all make a living, if you think you're an artist, I believe you're fooling yourself.
If you had to compose music specifically for this week's financial woes, how would you approach that?
There would be a great deal of turmoil in the music. By that I mean it would certainly be not only in a minor key, but in a minor key with jagged motion. Say if you played a B-flat minor chord, well, a logical chord to play after that might be an E-flat minor chord. I wouldn't do that this week. I'd play a B-flat minor chord, and then maybe I'd play an E minor chord as opposed to an E flat minor chord because it's jagged. It's not what you expect to hear. And then rhythmically, it would be like drums churning up like crazy, like, you know, the bubbling up of the indigestion that you're feeling as your money disappears. And then a bunch of low textures, low strings, and fast-moving low strings, and slow-moving low strings. And basically it would sound like Psycho without the on the top.
I'm getting a headache just thinking about this.
Well, were you getting a headache before I told you this, just thinking about the financial crisis?
I was getting a headache for the last few weeks, actually.
There you go, John.
Composer Peter Fish, thank you so much for joining us.
John Moe, thank you so very much for having me.
Composer Peter Fish will be appearing this weekend on channels 2, 7, 44, and probably 112. And that's it for another hour of American Public Media's Weekend America. Our program is produced with Ben Adair, who's spending his first weekend as a dad. We welcome young Gabriel Ash Scholar Adair to the world. Gabriel has already been handed 3 editing assignments. Sasha Aslanian also produces the show, as does Julia Barton, Desiree Cooper, Sam Keenan, Rob Byers, who's recording Waterfowl this weekend, Michael Raphael, who is also recording Waterfowl. Those guys really know how to party. Chrissy Clark, Brendan Newnham, Ocean Kalen, Ariel Kitch, Angela Kim, Zach Rose, Mark Sanchez, who's deploying brigades of winter clothes this weekend. It's a winter clothes surge in Minnesota. And Chris Wieg. Our theme music was created by Galactic. Our executive producer is Peter Clowney. Jim Russell created the show. You can get a free podcast of today's program from our website, weekendamerica.org. It's also available on iTunes. Here's a joke for this week. At least 3 different people have sent me this joke. You ready? Guy walks into a bar. Ow! Do you have any better jokes than that? Please, please send them along to me. I'm John Moe. Bye now.
This program is made possible with support from AIR, the Association of Independents in Radio, and public radio stations including WMFE Orlando, KUOW Seattle, and KNOW St. Paul, and made possible by grants from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Weekend America is produced and distributed by American Public Media.
Hi, this is John Moe, host of Weekend America. The weekends are for sweet reminiscences.
What I decided was that I would never have a favorite song and that instead I would hate all music forever.
You know, I don't like Hall & Oates anymore. That's how much I did not enjoy that situation.
We're making new memories, so you can go ahead and forget those old ones. Join us for the next Weekend America.